Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thanks for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. And by once again, I mean for the first time in 2 weeks, the Easter holiday got our podcast last week, Nick. I think it went out with the eggs.
Yeah, listen, you know, similar to the story arc of Jesus, we took a little hiatus and we have come back. So I think that was one of the best things we could do. Give ourselves a little bit of a break, celebrate Jesus. You know, Easter is sneaky. One of the better, like, oh, well, we might as well just start boozing and having mimosas after the, you know, 8 a.m. mass. So I've always been a huge fan of Easter because of my faith, but also because it's kind of really fun.
My family was in town, and it wasn't 8 a.m. mass. It was 10 a.m. mass. But yeah, the mimosas immediately started at like 11:15.
Yeah, we were texting each other, very misspelled text, like, hey, I think we might have to push it. I was like, okay, perfect. So
we are recording this in the closing moments of what is currently Yale's 16-13 victory over Albany and prior to the Ohio State-Michigan game. If something happens with that, we'll record an addendum. But in the interest of making sure that we had a tailgate podcast for week 11, we are going to dive into the action, and we are going to start with number one Maryland's 22-7 victory over Johns Hopkins. For the last like 3 weeks in my poll, I've basically written, I don't have anything else to say about Maryland, and I still feel that way. But I do have something to say about this game, and I feel like there is nobody more qualified to talk about exactly what I want to talk about when it comes to this game than you. And Nick, the question I have is how much respect is too much? No. Wow, I butchered that. How much disrespect is either the appropriate amount of disrespect or too much disrespect?
I'm going to quote a movie. The limit does not exist. If this is rivalry week and you're going up against a team that is, you know, historically one of the biggest lacrosse games, and you have a chance to embarrass them on a national stage.
And they've won like 30 more games than you in your series.
Yeah. This was awesome because Maryland has no reason to, you know, they have nothing left to prove this season before postseason starts. They could lose out and still be the number one. This was fun because I know there were at least a couple players in that locker room when you know you're better than a team, and especially if that team is your rival. Holy shit. You get to switch your mindset from we got to go win this game to I want this game to ruin their program and their recruiting for 5 to 10 years. I want this to be talked about 20 years from now, 50 years from now, and they did it. This was the largest margin of victory in any Maryland Hopkins game. This game is going to be brought up with every single recruit. This game is going to be brought up years down the line. Hopkins could win it in 2 years and they'd say, oh, did you win 22-7? No, then shut up. So as far as rivalry games, the amount of disrespect, there is none. There is no level of threshold. I would have liked to see it even more just because I know that Maryland was playing for keeps for, you know, this was a legacy victory. And very, very few times do you get to actively know that you're going into a game that's going to impact the legacy of two programs. Like Scott Van Pelt on Twitter was even like, holy moly, like this Maryland team's unbelievable. And all the Hopkins fans were like, okay, I don't like it here and I want to go home. Mom, can you come pick me up? I'm scared. What are your thoughts on the level of disrespect?
So they're multifaceted. The first is that when it comes to the game itself, there wasn't that much about this game that was very different from Maryland's win over Albany, Maryland's win over Penn State, Maryland's win over Rutgers. The only recent Maryland game that actually looked different was Ohio State. Late in the third quarter last Saturday, I thought the Buckeyes actually had a chance to beat them. Now, how foolish was I? They ended up losing by 7. But yeah, at the same time, I mean, they went into Addy Field and Virginia played them kind of tight early, if memory serves. It was 23-12. Like, Maryland has done this The difference was, and this is why I thought talking about whether or not the 8.5 goal spread was going to be covered in the second quarter was a little foolish, because that 8.5 goal spread was never about whether Maryland could beat Johns Hopkins by 8.5 goals. It was whether or not they would. And my issue with every spread, 5.5 goals and more, is all about the backdoor. I have no doubt that the team that wins is at some point in the game going to be leading by 6 goals or more. So when Maryland went up by 9, I was like, that's fine. They're going to start subbing liberally in the fourth quarter, and Hopkins is going to continue to play hard because it's a rivalry game. So what's going to prevent this from ending up at 19-10? I'm sorry, that's the wrong number that I should have picked. 19-12, in which case they cover. So when it was late in the third quarter, they hadn't started subbing at all. Logan McNaney was still making saves. It was kind of like, oh, yeah, it feels like there might be a little bit something else going on. But it wasn't until after the game when Hopkins made an apparently ill-advised decision to host their senior day on the field post-game, and Maryland sent a former Johns Hopkins Blue Jay, Owen Murphy, who transferred after being quasi-dismissed from the program in December of 2020. He transferred after the 2021 season because he wasn't going to be able to get into Maryland for the 21 season. He had options to go elsewhere, but decided to miss the year because he wanted to be in College Park. He's emerged as a really valuable second-line midfield asset, and he had a great day against his former team. He was the one that went up and got the Crabs. So they're celebrating on the field as the Hopkins seniors are having their senior day. Just about as awkward as it gets.
I mean, awkward is not the right word. Humiliating, dominating. I appreciate that the level of hate is still where it should be in the sport of lacrosse. You know, I'm kind of, especially like in the pros, like a lot of these rivalries are kind of rivalries just because, oh, you know, it's manufactured and this and that. It's good to see two teams just hate each other like this. Also, on the side note, DeMeo's 25 years old. Is that right?
Yes. How crazy is that?
Of all the things that are happening, how is just a 25-year-old stepping in and playing for Maryland? There should be a couple of rules against that. And I even like him. I've seen him around San Diego a couple times. But, dude, I mean,
get out of it.
Senior year when I was able to buy booze for the first time, or late junior year, sorry. And I was like, holy moly, I can buy booze. This guy's been buying booze for his team for 4 years now, only to distribute to the people that are 21 and above, of course.
Of course.
And then the final note, the thing that has me really scared about this, this Maryland team is there was that viral, pseudo-viral of, I think it was Wisnowkis feeding DeMeo, right?
Yes.
Running full speed down the alley, throwing a lefty kind of like low, maybe sidearm pass that went right to the head of the stick. It's the toughest part of going from college to pros is realizing that, like, hey, what was a threat in college is now changed because you can play good defense and sometimes players are just going to make unbelievable plays. And the professional stick skills of, hey, if we don't slide and get on those hands immediately, that skip pass is going to be there 90% of the time. I mean, this Maryland team is executing at a professional level with plays like that. And to be honest, there's nothing you can do defensively. Slide early, he's going to beat you. Slide a little bit late, and he's going to throw a lethal skip pass. So everyone's wondering, why is this Maryland team so good? I think it's plays like Wisnowkis's feed to DeMeo that are separating this and deservedly kind of putting them in that, is this a historically good team? Because that's a rare feed. That is a rare feed.
So I don't want to say too much more on this topic because, as I said at the top, I have said all of it too frequently, but I want to address that point specifically just from the standpoint of a couple of things surrounding the Torton. I think there's this perception that Logan Wisnowskis is a more limited player than Brendan Nichter and Chris Gray, Connor Schellenberger, in terms of his ability to initiate offense. And I think that specifically refers to, I'm going to square up the opponent's best defender off of an end line restart, and I'm going to run past him. And I thought Saturday night, he did a really good job of showcasing the variety of skills that he's got in his toolbox that make him so dangerous. Because I've spent the majority of this season talking about the primary attribute that he brings to the table is how rarely or how infrequently the ball is in his stick and how quickly it gets out of his stick. And the permeating nature of how that makes the rest of the offense so unselfish, and how the role delineation has been so good and so clear, and how interesting it's been that Keegan Khan has actually shouldered more of the primary initiator load. But Wisnowskis' performance on Saturday against Johns Hopkins was of the level of, yes, he is not as athletic as Connor Schellenberger, and perhaps he isn't as multifacetedly dangerous as Chris Gray, but he can do everything. And he is 6'4", 220 pounds, and those other guys are not. So don't undersell. This is what I'm getting at. If Maryland goes undefeated and win the national championship, Logan Wisnowskis is going to win the Tewarden. And there will be people that will compare that award to Mike Lavelle winning it for Syracuse in 2008 when everybody thought Paul Rabil was the better player or whatever. And certainly at the pro level, that probably bore out. But Logan Wisnowskis, in my opinion, is going to go to the PLL and potentially the NLL, because I think his skills translate pretty nicely to that league as well, and exceed expectations because of what his reputation has been as a college player.
I couldn't agree more. The skill sets that, like, you know, just to kind of echo home that point, it's a different game, especially NLL, but just like the skill sets that you have to prepare for, where it's like, oh my God, like I thought I was playing good defense, but guys at this level can just do this way better. Skip passes being kind of the first one. And then, you know, there are a couple other things, but a lot of it is just kind of like being able to pick apart and not just have that. Because, you know, you see great players that run by people just because college players aren't as athletic as pro players. And it's like, oh, that guy's just simply more athletic. And a lot of those guys don't have great pro careers. Like, Wisnowskis to me is, you know, I would consider him maybe outside of Chris Gray, the number two overall pick. I think he is pro ready right now. So,
well, there are three different ways that I can segue into the next game we're going to talk about.
One, speaking of Chris Gray.
The other being, speaking of teams that don't like each other. And the third being, speaking of teams that could potentially give Maryland a game. And that's why we're going to talk about Notre Dame's 12-5 win over North Carolina on Thursday night as the second game on this rundown, even though it is the oldest game that we could potentially be talking about. Because you texted me on Saturday after the, like, 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock games ended, and you were just like, I don't know who's good. And I shared with you a conversation that I had had with somebody else where I basically was just like, everybody stinks except for Notre Dame. And that's why we're going to talk about them. So it was funny that I got an article sent to me a little early last week or mid last week that called Georgetown the hottest team, with the implication being that, I don't know, they, well, obviously were the hottest team. But if you're talking about heat as at one point you were cold and now you're not cold, I think you can make an argument for Brown, but I think Notre Dame is pretty clearly hotter than the Brown Bears are. And to me, the reason is because the difference between who they were prior to this most recent winning streak and now is so clearly tied to Jake Taylor's insertion as a starter offensively. He had 3 goals in the win over Carolina. Eric Dobson had 4. I don't think those things are unrelated. I do think that the amount of space that Dobson has for his step down is a reflection or a result of the gravity that Taylor has created. And specifically, it's not just him and his skill set. It's the essentially the ability to catch all the passes that Pat and Chris Kavanaugh throw to him. But at the same time, they only scored 12 goals. They won this game so convincingly because the defense limited Carolina to 5. And my question for you is, like, how much is that as a reflection of Notre Dame's defensive quality? And I would just say, before you say Notre Dame is the best defense in college lacrosse, because we have been for 15 years, they got 14 saves from Liam Entenmann. Duke held Carolina to 6, and I think it was 2 after 3 quarters, and UVA held Carolina to 4. So there are some flaws in this Tar Heel offense as well. But what did you see on Thursday night?
So first off, I tweeted it out, but it was a tale of two teams. It was a team that's fierce, ready to prove themselves as a national championship contender, and it was a team that had its tail between its legs walking out to the opening faceoff. Just the difference in two programs. If I'm a recruit, I scratch UNC off, and I immediately transfer or commit to Notre Dame. But aside from that, what I did see, I was extremely optimistic and proud of this Notre Dame defense for recognizing what is a true threat and what isn't. And allow me to make a cross-reference to the NLL for a second. The San Diego Seals, I think, best defensive performance was against the Calgary Roughnecks, because Curtis Dixon is a dynamic player. But to recognize when a guy like Curtis Dixon is a threat and when he's going to back away and look for a skip feed – is crucial. And that analogy ties directly into Chris Gray, because there were several times, whether it was Chris Gray who did most of the work, because this UNC offense is a dump, I was very excited to see them recognize what was a sellout, I'm dodging to score, and what was a, oh, well, you know, if I give up that shot, we can expect Entman to make a save because it's a low angle, because his momentum is taking him away from the goal. There are probably, you know, like 10 to 15 different factors on what you should slide to, what you should collapse to, and like have the entire red alert. Everybody needs to go stop this. And what is a, oh, well, that's just kind of a fake threat. And if I slide, there's going to be a skip pass wide open, which I think only happened once or twice the entire game. I will say UNC hit a lot of pipes. Yeah. But I think that was one of the things that was really worrying me about this Notre Dame defense early, that they've made monster strides to. And you can kind of expect that. With more experience comes kind of a more mature understanding of the game. And I think you hit the nail on the head with just Jake Taylor having to, you know, have more of a, oh, if we let this guy get hot, he'll score 8 goals. And I think that even while you have the Kavanaughs and you have other threats, I don't think that the Kavanaughs are as good of pure finishers as a guy like Jake Taylor. I think that, you know, the statistics and just how they play definitely backs all of that up. But having a guy like, you know, I think back to, you know, like DU when Mark Matthews was on that team. And it's like if they throw the ball at him on the crease, it's going to be a goal. We need to pay attention to him the entire time. I think that is the dynamic piece that was missing from this offense. I love Dobson scoring 4 goals. I remember him as a freshman. The only thing that worries me is, in the same way that teams can recognize when Chris Gray is going full sail, I think Dobson is transparent in his dodges, and he'll be slid to earlier next game, and he has the potential to be limited easier than a Jake Taylor. But all that to say, it's like,
I mean, he's like. Their games are incredibly similar. Like, to me, the best that you want to get out of Eric Dobson is 1 goal on the run, such that every dodge is going to be slid to, at which point he can make the mental decision that, like, I'm either not going to shoot this, I'm just going to throw ahead, or I'm going to shoot and probably miss the cage wildly, but the reason I'm doing this is to put pressure on the defense, because the way I'm actually going to score goals is I'm going to initiate the offense with a dodge down the alley. It's going to get the defense spinning, and I'm going to be the beneficiary of 5 passes later. I'm going to be open for a step down. That, I think, is what you... And it's not to say that, like, he hasn't been a better passer at points this season than he was as a freshman, because he absolutely has been. And I do think that the thing that this offense really can expect in terms of continuing to raise its ceiling in coming weeks is Wheaton Jacobois' continued improvement over the course of this season, right? Like, he hasn't played nearly as well as he did last year, and I think a lot of that was because of how much the ball's been taken out of his stick as a passer. To me, that was like the biggest indicator of this offense not playing as well as it did last year and how much better it can play, is he has shown the ability to be a feeder. He has not, in prior years, he has not done it this year. The offense has played better the last 3 games. He still has not. That is available to Notre Dame in terms, like, a big Wheaton Jacobois game is coming, And I don't know whether it's against Syracuse or North or Duke, or in the first round of the NCAA tournament. But when it comes, it's the type of thing that the opposing defense is not going to be prepared for.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I think it's one of the things on my to-do list is to go and watch that first game against Maryland. You know, it's I look at the progression of this Notre Dame season, the three losses, Georgetown, Maryland, and Ohio State in late February, early March. You know, I'm actually fine with those three losses. And you phrased it as they just need to play 20% better. And I think I love talking about Dobson and Taylor as it relates to this offense being more dynamic. I think that alone is 20% better. Will Lynch, credit to him. He's been playing fantastic the last couple games. This defense, Eneman, so
who called
what?
That?
No, you didn't. I called
it. Yes, I did. How dare you?
Anything's possible when you lie, Terry. I've been saying that for years.
I might dig up the audio to play right here. I probably won't, but I might. And yeah, I remember being like, yeah, he's a freshman. He's going to get better.
You did call it. The only thing that worries me is when a faceoff guy gets hot, like it's, I don't want Notre Dame to be the March Madness team that lives and dies by the 3-point, because they're going to make a big upset and then we beat someone. And then if Will Lynch goes cold and we rely too much on a guy like him, you know, this is why we need to ban the faceoff. But I just hope that he gets more consistent. I would rather see him go steadily 50% than go hot and cold, because that's, you know, I don't need to talk about Notre Dame's faceoff woes as it pertains to playoff performance. And then the final point that I'll say is I love the way this Notre Dame roster is structured, because I think it tees up some really interesting things in the future. You look at the big contributors. Yes, you have the Kavanaughs from New York, and, you know, every goddamn player in D1 is from New York or Pennsylvania or Maryland, whatever. But like Dobson from Florida, Jake Taylor grew up near Wheat Ridge, Colorado, which gives you a huge advantage. Jacoboys, I think he went to Culver, but he's originally from Kansas City. And then Mo Meyer from San Diego. So in the same way that Denver was kind of always thought of as, oh, they're going to be this consortium of all of the best players outside of the East Coast, I think that Notre Dame is starting to tell a pretty interesting story of, hey, look at all these contributors. You know, I know the only thing missing from this roster might be a couple Canadians, but, you know, I just looking for to the future, because I'm trying my best, Terry. I really am, to not get cocky and talk a bunch of shit about what we're going to do in the playoffs, because it always comes back to bite me in the ass. But I like the way this roster is structured for future recruiting purposes. I like the way this team is playing. There's not a particular area in which I think we need full sail help. And, you know, I think if I'm Maryland, I'm terrified of seeing Notre Dame in the playoffs.
I mean, you can talk all you want about how the roster is geographically diverse, but you're still a finishing school for Chaminade with Pat Kavanaugh, Chris Kavanaugh, Riley Gray, Will Lynch, Liam Entenmann. You want me to keep going?
No.
I do want to clean up something that I tweeted last week, though. Actually, 2 weeks ago, when Carolina suffered their injuries at the faceoff X against Virginia, that was the game that Petey LaSala was expected potentially to miss because he left at halftime or late in the first half in the prior game against Richmond, and then played against Carolina. Zach Tucci and Andrew Tyre both left the game due to injury during the game. And I tweeted that, you know, they must be planning to redshirt Chase Mullins, who was an Under Armour All-American. He was actually the MVP of the Under Armour All-American game. And the Tar Heels had turned to Graham Schwartz to take draws. Well, we saw that again on Thursday night, and I've since learned that Mullins has left the team and left school. Whether he returns at some point in the future to Carolina is to be determined, but at this point he's not on the roster. So just like I said, okay? Cleaning up something, you know, that I had said previously.
Is he okay? Do you know?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
All right, moving on. What could potentially prevent... Well, actually, I got one more thing to say about Carolina, which is that you know, despite this recent run of bad form that was a little bit interrupted by an important win over Syracuse, which we didn't talk about and eliminated the Orange's postseason hopes, there's an expectation within the program that if they beat Duke, they're going to qualify for the NCAA tournament. So in addition to that, in addition to how this win over Carolina spiked Notre Dame's RPI all the way up to number 12, and Saturday's action made it fluctuate a little bit before the Albany-Yale game, Notre Dame's RPI was 13. So it had dropped one spot as a result of what happened on Saturday. But that is very much within the potential bubble expectation and certainly the likelihood that it increases over the course of the next two games is high, meaning that Notre Dame's got a reasonable expectation for NCAA tournament inclusion as well. But Notre Dame, Carolina, Duke, whomever, who could keep them out? Well, we, according to all the prognosticators who know the NCAA selection criteria well, need to start preparing ourselves for the possibility of six Ivy League teams in the tournament. And that is largely a result of Harvard 19, Princeton 16. Austin Madronic was incredibly clutch with two goals down the stretch. Lucas Hilsenrath, a freshman who had played in, I believe, only three games and scored once to this point this season, had the dagger to put the Crimson up by three. And, you know, Yale is legitimately young. Penn and Princeton are deceptively old. Cornell is a little bit old in some spots, and then they've got some youth contributing in other spots, and now they're battling injury. They're pretty normal. Harvard is deceptively young. That's how I would put it. They're playing three first years down, well, if not down low. Chase Strupp's injury changed up that a little bit in the middle of the season, but he only missed one game and he's back. But between the backup long stick spot and then the other two close defensemen, they're starting a couple freshmen. And then even though, you know, in Cheek and Madronic and a couple of the middies, they've got some experience at the offensive end. You know, Sam King has probably been their most consistent player. He's certainly the initiator of their offense. So Harvard getting better as the year went along, is kind of the point I've been driving at, shouldn't be surprising. They had an unbelievably good crowd, and this win over Princeton is a huge win that totally jumbles up the Ivy League tournament situation. There are five teams tied at 3-2. Penn is 3-3, and Dartmouth is 0-5. So this last weekend of the Ivy League regular season is going to tell us who gets in and who gets left out. It's absolutely insane.
I'm already so damn worried. You know, it's the narrative that's kind of been building for a while now. You know, I think we brought it up almost every episode is when the Ivy League did so good out of conference that the last thing we needed was a bloodbath. And Terry, it's turned on to a full-on Ivy League bloodbath.
And when you say that, what you're saying is like the best case scenario for everybody else would have been like three teams going 5-1, one team going 0-6, and then every other team going 2-4, 1-5.
Yes,
exactly. So this five teams being 3-2 and one team being 3-3 is exactly what you didn't want.
It's the
worst. Do you think the nerds colluded?
Huh?
Do you think the nerds colluded?
I'm getting ready to push the narrative. I also think that this is the textbook case of we need to ban the RPI unless it benefits Notre Dame next year. But for right now, I think coming out of COVID, listen, the world's in a crazy time, the economy, inflation, get rid of the RPI, go back to the eye test. Notre Dame beat the brakes off of UNC. That alone should qualify them. I'm trying to figure out a way to talk about how the Ivy League doesn't deserve all of these spots, and it's extremely difficult. Did you ever see those circles of suck, which is like this team beat this team and
yes,
in this conference?
Those.
It's not the circle of suck. It's the circle of like, oh my God, these teams are all really good. Maybe we can workshop it right now. How do we shift this narrative and what needs to happen to make sure that the Ivy League is not a 16 bid? Are we still rooting for teams to separate themselves from the pack, or are we rooting for like I don't even know if there are any other. I think, like, you know, Penn plays St. Joe's because our idiot intern is on St.
That
Joe's.
That is correct.
Like, are we Hail Marrying some last second out of conference upsets? Are we hoping for teams to separate themselves from the pack? Like, what are we even hoping for that's against the best wishes of the Ivy League right now?
So my assumption, I don't know this for sure, but my assumption is that there. Okay, so my assumption is that you want the teams with the best RPIs to make the tournament, to make the Ivy League tournament. So point being, Penn's RPI right now is number 5. They're not getting left out regardless. There is no chance that they don't get into the tournament. So what you don't want is Penn to miss the Ivy League tournament, and as a result, one of the other teams like Harvard to get that benefit. So I think what you're cheering for is Harvard to lose and Cornell to lose, because Harvard plays Yale, whose RPI before their win over Albany was number 4. They're getting in. Cornell plays Princeton, who after their loss to Harvard, their RPI was still number 2. They're getting in. So those four, you know, those two teams play each other, Princeton, Cornell, and Harvard, Yale. So I think you want Princeton and Yale to win and then just see how far Cornell and Harvard's RPIs can fall as a result. I think that's your best hope. I don't think anything else is going to have a material effect, especially now that Yale closed out Albany with a 17-13 win.
Yep, that's a bummer. All right, well, you know, maybe I, you know, got some friends over at Harvard. Maybe I just start hoping for Harvard.
Get them to lay down.
Huh?
You can get them to lay down.
Yeah, I don't know who we have to bribe, you know, lie, cheat, steal, but
I mean, their endowment is like this world's 7th largest economy or something like that, so I don't think you're going to be able to pull that off.
Yeah, but a crisp $5 bill and clout. What if I tweeted about them? Clout lives forever, Terry.
That's true.
But also, like, actually interesting game.
You know,
like,
what you need to do?
What's that?
Million Bitcoin idea right here. We need to create crypto clout.
I'm going to hang up this call right now.
So that you can go and do it and make sure that nobody else beats you to the punch?
No, because I hate that idea. It seems like work, and I'm going to go get this done right now. I'm going to give you 1 million clout coins right off the bat, and then I'm going to go jump off a bridge.
All right.
Did you see Harvard in any way beating Princeton, though? This was one of the games where, like, okay, I truly have this in the Brown Cornell, which we'll talk about in a second, where I was like, okay, perfect. Then I really don't have any idea. And Navy Army and Boston Lehigh and Richmond High Point. But,
so I picked Princeton.
Harvard plays 10 times. What's the split of those games?
I didn't give this game enough thought before the game to feel like I'm answering honestly.
But neither did I.
I did say this week that, because I, you know, I was, somebody said, like, who could have seen this Ivy League performance coming in the preseason? I was like, well, I did. I had 4 Ivy League teams in my top 17, and I was just, but I had Princeton lowest, and so I said, by that logic, I suppose I am most impressed by what Princeton did. And I've said repeatedly over the course of the season that the thing about who they are and what they've done that impresses me the most is the contribution from guys 12 through 19 on their roster. Because when you look at their guys' ability to contribute at the pro level, Schreiber, Currier, etc., like Ficarro, it's not their star talent that is the big, that was the big differentiator between the 2010s versus the 2000s. When I looked at why they were, you know, losing first round NCAA tournament games at Charlottesville 6-5, it was because that next layer, their second line middies, their fourth attackman, you know, their fourth defenseman, weren't performing at the level of what they had been in the prior 2 decades. So when I look at what they've done in 12 games this season and what I'm impressed by, it is those spots on the field. Because again, like, Mike Sowers was not the reason that they weren't a tournament team. And now they're, by all metrics, second, third, fourth best team in the country. And for them to lose to Harvard, like, to me, it's one of those kind of cop-out answers where it's like, I'm not necessarily surprised that Harvard won. I'm surprised that Harvard won by scoring 19 goals and giving up 16. If you had said, how's Harvard going to win this game? I would have said, well, they're going to win 12-10. They're going to find a way to get to 50% facing off by mucking it up, and they're going to control possession. And I had this game on the second screen while I was watching Army-Navy, but that's not how this game unfolded. They took every punch offensively and responded with every punch offensively.
Yeah, and that's another reason why I don't know who's good and who's bad. Jerry Burns' Harvard team wins 19-16 against a team that I, you know, was in the top three for a good quarter of the season. I don't, like, not only do I not know the outcomes of games, I don't know if it's going to be a 6-8 snooze fest or a shootout. So I don't know, Terry. I feel like I'm losing my mind. I'm going crazy. Up is down, down is up, left is right. Bald is hair, hair is bald. You tell
me. But we have a hero. Brown 13, Cornell 8, Connor Terrio, 24 saves. I told you about him, what, 3 weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
You got eyes on him. Larkin Kemp is calling him America's goalie. I need Nick Acella's take on Connor Terrio. He's 5'7", 210 pounds.
Have you seen his highlights playing attack in Summer League?
I have not. Are you sure it's him and not his, I believe, twin brother Jack?
I am sure. Well, I guess Larkin vouched for it. So,
okay.
So long as we can trust Larkin Kemp, which I would with my life, I think we can trust that. This is one of my favorite athletes, and I feel like he needs to join in on the John Daly and immediately sign an NIL deal with Hooters. He just, from everything that I've heard about him, he's the guy that you want to start the pregame. He's the guy that you want in your summer league, and he's the guy that is always making everybody have the best time of all time. Oh, and by the way, he stuffs Cornell 24 times in a row and leads Brown to one of their biggest victories of the season. Like,
Christian Sweezy was on site because he wrote a book about Cornell's history, and he was selling them at the game. So he wrote the game story, and the lead to his game story was, what's the difference between Connor Terrio and a brick wall?
What's that?
A brick wall gives up rebounds.
Okay. I like that. I feel like if you gave me a little bit, I can text something over to you that we might not be able to say, but I would be better than that.
I believe you.
Yeah, and again, Larkin was even in our ears about it for a while, and we were kind of just like, yeah. When Larkin talks about Brown, when I talk about Notre Dame, people just kind of hit mute. But he was spot on, and you know, hearing the rumor mills from the Brown alumni, you know, I think the people's goalie might make sense. I honestly do, and I hate to agree with Larkin publicly because now I'm just going to get lit up in group chats about how I'm a homer. And but I feel like the sister schools is back. Notre Dame and Brown as the you know, the best friends of all time, led by Connor. And we were starting to do like the ooh kill 'em Connor Terrio, but I don't know if that works or not. I really don't. But give me some time to workshop it. I'll get back to you.
One more thing I want to say about this game is that Cornell got smoked by Army. Brown smoked Yale. This was not that. If you're a Cornell fan, take heart. You should feel good about your team's chances heading into Princeton. Now, obviously, you know, playing a angry Princeton team is probably less advantageous than playing an unangry or a satisfied, fat and happy Princeton team. But what I saw from this game, all hope is not lost.
No. And if there was ever a season to just maintain hope, it's this one.
No doubt. So, as mentioned, Yalbany. Yalbany is actually a really good nickname for that sale, that rivalry.
Yeah.
Yale 17, Albany 13. You know, just quickly on this one, I'm starting to think that Yale's defensive performances against Penn and Princeton were an aberration, and this is not a good defense. And, you know, early on, they were losing faceoffs and not getting stops, but the offense was on fire. In the middle of the game, they started facing off better. And then the offense started to turn the ball over, and then the defense tightened up, and then you know, basically that was kind of the end. Yale benefited from a faceoff violation penalty that turned their two-goal spurt into a four-goal rally, and then they were able to put the game away late. But, you know, I've been really high on this Bulldog team over the course of the season, and this is kind of the first time I'm wavering a little bit. So I don't know what it means relative to a Harvard-Yale game. This might be exactly what the Bulldogs need in order to play well and be focused. I think they probably benefit from the fact that it's in Reese Stadium. I don't know that if they had to go to Cambridge, I would feel as good about their chances to win. And then, yeah, Ivy League tournament seedings are a total crapshoot. So we shall see.
Yale has been playing good all year long. I can't get over thinking they're not that good of a team because of their, I think it was like late February loss to Penn State when I...
Yep.
We were already talking about how Penn State's the worst team of all time, which turned out to be 30% true. Suck it, Mac O'Keefe. And how does Yale lose to Penn State, and how much do I cling on to that in hopes that now the Ivy League isn't as good as I think?
Yeah, 100%. So at the time, people thought I was crazy for doing this, but well, not crazy because it took like 20 minutes, but I watched every Alaric Fayak save. And the reason I was so interested in how that game unfolded is because I had watched a little bit of the Lafayette game where I believe he made two saves and let in 10 goals in the first half. Now, granted, the game was in Haluba Hall, which is one of the worst places to play goalie in the entire country. Potentially the Moose being the only other one that is just as bad. That's what it's called, right? Your indoor facility?
No, it's the Goog.
The Goog. What office, was the Moose? Am I making that up?
No, I think isn't the Moose like Michigan's maybe? What's Michigan's called?
Well, they have I don't know. We'll never revisit this topic. Yeah. But whatever. Moving on. So he made 21 saves in a 10-6 Penn State win. And I was just like, how many saves were great saves? Basically, how many goals did he steal versus how much of it was good defense versus how much of it was bad offense? And I kind of came away thinking that it was one-third, one-third, one-third. And when you try to suss that out into, okay, well then, to your point earlier, if you play this game 10 times, how many times does Penn State win? It kind of depends on how many great saves you can expect a goalie to make. Because if he made six or seven, is it reasonable to expect him to make two or three? Because in that case, it's an overtime game, right? Is it reasonable to expect him to make four? Because in that case, it's a 10-8 win. So that's where I like, you know, there's no question that Yale's offense played poorly. Yale's defense played just fine. Jarrett Paquette also made like 16 saves, so you can do the exact opposite in terms of trying to analyze that result. But the other side of the coin is that we don't ask these questions about Penn and Cornell because they won by one. If Yale had won that game by one, it would have been a survive advance, file it away, move on, doesn't matter, you got the win, right? So it's only the fact that they lost that it has become a point of fixation or a point of contention. And I think at this point, why don't we just quickly talk about the fact that Rutgers nearly suffered a similar fate. They were trailing 14-11 to Penn State. By the way, do you know that this game gets played for a trophy?
Rutgers-Ohio State?
Rutgers-Penn State.
Or Rutgers-Penn State? Really?
Yeah. You know what the trophy's
What's
called?
The trophy? Just like some guy's like old shoe?
You're going to love this. It's called the Friendship Cup.
Oh my God. What the hell is going on? Why? Why is this a thing?
I'm sure that we're being incredibly insensitive and insulting somebody by laughing at the Friendship Cup, but it is a you know, like a normal looking trophy, but it's actually, I saw a photo of it on the field post game and it was still in like its glass containment or you know, plexiglass like covering. I was like, if there's one time in the year that you bring the trophy out of its like container, it's when you give it to the team who just won it on the field, especially when they won it in overtime. But to not bury the lead, Shane Knobloch was incredible down the stretch, having four assists in the last, I think he assisted on Rutgers' last four goals, or if not the last four, then four last five or four last six. And, Yeah, Ross Scott had both the game tying goal with 8 seconds left and the game winner on Manop in overtime. So Jules Henningberg versus Mac O'Keefe. This one goes to Jules.
This one goes out the window. It's the Friendship Cup in overtime. Yes. They don't take the trophy out. So first off, apologies to if this was like, you know, this is in memoriam to someone and it's super important, but this is now my least favorite game in lacrosse, and I'm going to start campaigning to get it canceled. The Friendship Cup.
Yes.
Hey, we just lost in overtime. All right, everybody, you know, go out and stand in a
award
line,
the
and
Friendship
we're going
to
do a big round
to
of
your
hugs.
Friends.
And then we're going to sing Kumbaya, and then I'm going to order an Uber, and I'm going to go stand in the middle of the street and request that the Uber just hits me for attending the Friendship Cup. So I'm actually going to decline
there.
Comments on this. Jules, Matt, you guys
crowds.
Are both on the end line.
All over the country. Speaking of a rivalry game that went to overtime where...
Oh, man.
They're probably not friends. They probably actually do hate each other, but then they have to work side by side for the next 5 years. Navy 12, Army 11. This was my game, so I could talk a lot about it. By virtue of Navy winning, it actually matters and has a little bit more stakes than it otherwise would have. I think a lot of folks considered... Well, actually, I know this because when we posted our bracketology on Instagram on Friday, the comments absolutely flamed me for not having Army in the field. They were, I believe, number 5 in the Inside Lacrosse media poll, and it just speaks to the fact that, like, on a social media by social media basis, like platform to platform, the audience understands on a much different level what actually determines the outcomes of things like selection. And it turns out that Instagram ranks far behind Twitter in terms of people understanding the difference between a poll and the RPI in terms of influencing the committee's selection. All that being said, Army was never really an at-large contender. They had an RPI of 20 heading into this weekend, and certainly this result does not help. That being said, Navy, I believe, clinched a spot in the Patriot League tournament by virtue of Colgate losing to Loyola in overtime, which I would say we can talk about in a second, but I'll just get it out of the way now. Evan James, Loyola was losing 10-8 at Colgate with like 4 minutes to go, and Evan James took assists from 3 different guys over the course of the last couple minutes of regulation and then in overtime in order to win that game and avoid an upset that would look a lot worse than it actually was when you realize that Colgate played Harvard to a goal, played Army to a 2-goal loss that they were leading by either a goal or two late, and then just beat Lehigh. So Colgate finishing the season strong. Congratulations to Matt Carwick and his staff for really getting their team pointed in the right direction as the season went on. That being said, Navy clinched a spot in the Patriot League tournament. And, you know, talking to Joe Amplo postgame, it was just a typical Army-Navy rivalry. I mean, you know, I know that the Service Academy rivalry is, well, Air Force, I don't even know. You certainly don't consistently play. I don't know whether you played Army or Navy when you were an assistant on the team. But at the same time, I'm sure that you can imagine what it would be like if you did. And the short answer to the question is those teams want to beat each other very badly. And it typically manifests in a lot of sloppiness. And for Navy, it manifested in 13 first-half turnovers. They got a really good performance from Nate Hammond at the faceoff X. These were two teams that were facing off very, very differently coming into this game. And that allowed them to overcome that faceoff deficiency. That allowed them to overcome the turnover deficit. And then, you know, basically, I talked about how Harvard took Princeton's offensive punches and responded with offensive punches in kind. And I didn't think Navy was going to be able to do that over the course of this game. They came in, and when you looked at the 4 units, Army and Navy's offense and defense, Navy's offense was the significant outlier. They were below 40 in adjusted efficiency heading in. I believe they were 47, whereas the other 3 units were all above 30. And they got a big boost by Xavier Arline playing the first game since Johns Hopkins. He finished with 2 goals and 2 assists, and I think represented a dodging threat that otherwise this offense doesn't have. He was covered by Army's number 1 for a good portion of the game and consistently applied pressure even when he wasn't producing points, and that just creates a certain dynamic within this offense that it otherwise didn't have. And it all led up to an overtime questionable foul, James Pryor, a hold on Patrick Skalniak that hadn't really been called throughout the game, but, you know, Navy hadn't gotten a call to that point in the game. So Jack Sweeney, who is a senior captain and had started 10 games as a freshman, 3 games as a junior on attack, comes in for his first action of the game, 61 minutes in, and does a really nice job of kind of following the ball in the middle of a 5-man man-down unit, waited for the 2 top guys to float up a little bit. I believe Dane Swanson kept the low men low, and Jack Sweeney flashed to the ball, took a nice pass from Max Hewitt, and turning finish, and that was it. Celebration was on. Sing second. It was an incredible game.
That one of my favorite things in maybe all of sports. I'm appreciative of my time at Air Force for, you know, a number of reasons, but it changed the how service academies play each other, because everybody knows those storylines, Army, Navy, football, the presidents, their flyovers, and they post their schedules, and Air Force, Navy, and, you know, Army, Air Force, and all this stuff. And then after the game, it's like, oh, they left it all out there on the field. And then they go and sing their fight song. And then they go to the other corner and sing their fight song. And the pageantry is just so great. And the second the cameras turn off and the second the players get back into the locker room, they are like, I hate those guys so much, it blows my mind. Like, the narrative that these are just like guys that are respecting and then they're going to go serve. These are still college athletes who hate every opponent that they play, and they're not going to work with them tomorrow. They're like, I'll like them maybe, you know, years after. But there's these rivalries in between the branches of service anyways. And when it plays out in college sports and the entire country is talking about how much these two guys respect each other, meanwhile on the field they're like, hey, you know, I would say some of the chirps that I hear, you know, between service academies, but we would have to, you know, really edit out and beep all of it. So I just love that narrative in general, where it's like, look at these two teams respecting each other. Meanwhile, they're trying to slide high and late, and they hate each other so much, it does become sloppy. And I feel like, in contrast to Maryland Hopkins, in contrast to even Notre Dame UNC, there isn't really a gap big enough in Army-Navy, talent-wise, for me to think that it won't be a close game. I feel like these are two teams that hate each other enough to play sloppy. The worst team is always going to be like, this is our chance to get one over on our rivals. The better team is saying, we need to embarrass them so bad that we knock their stuff in the dirt, but it works against them. So honestly, a shocking upset just from a talent perspective. But if I was going to guess, the biggest upset of the year, any year, is if one of the service academies is good and if one of the service academies is not so good. That's my bid for upset any season.
Well said.
Not really, but I wish I could swear more, because I really could have emphasized how much they don't like each other. But out of respect for them.
Let's quickly wrap up the Patriot League. Boston University 9, Lehigh 8. This one assures that the Patriot League tournament will be in Beantown, as well as the Terriers having a bye through the quarterfinals to the championship. It was an incredible game. I really started to focus on it when BU was up 8-6. Connor Calderone had an excellent day against Mikey Sisselberger. I believe he finished at 57%. Might have been better than that even. And when I started watching probably the last like 10 minutes, I couldn't help just... And maybe it was a little earlier than that. It might not have been 8-6. I might have saw a few BU goals. But I was like, this feels like a playoff baseball game. It, just because... you know how in a playoff baseball game, when a runner gets to second... In the opposing, like if it's tied and there's a runner on second and it's the home team is pitching, the crowd starts to get really nervous, because if they score this run, like, you know, especially if it's a, you know, low scoring game in like the seventh or eighth inning, and you don't know, like, you're like, we're not going to score again. If they score here, we are screwed. That was kind of the way this game felt. And Lehigh got 2 goals late. Shout out to Justin Tiernan making his – well, he debuted against Colgate, but he didn't score in that game. And obviously it was a setback for Lehigh, but was pretty good down the stretch for the Mountain Hawks. And they managed to tie. But You know, I have written a fair amount about this over the course of the last 2 weeks. I actually went to BU's win over Loyola last week. And, you know, this is a Terrier team that has adjusted to their injury losses, primarily to Patrick Morrison, who's kind of, if not their best defender, because Roy Meyer is their best defender. That kid is incredible. Just as an aside, sometimes I think cause turnovers are the worst kept stat, meaning let me just put it this way. It may be true because of style of play and recruiting that Lehigh and Bellarmine consistently have the team or the player that creates the most turnovers, causes the most turnovers in a given season. But it could also be true that they are a little bit more liberal in their definition of a cause turnover at home in those two home stadiums than the rest of Division I. And that's why, having watched a lot of Roy Meyer over the course of the last, I don't know, 3 weeks, I think he's, well, no, like 5 or 6 weeks. And I think he's either first, second, or third in cause turnovers per game this season. They're all legit. That kid creates a ton of turnovers. But Patrick Morrison is their quarterback defensively, and they lost him. He might come back. Jake Cates was their number one midfielder, the guy who gets the pull, the guy who dodges the pull, the guy who starts so much of their offense. He's done for the year. Everybody bumps up. Christian Quadrino now probably going to be the guy that gets the pull most of the time. And Matt Hilburn is the guy who gets elevated to the first line. If you're a number six offense, which is a term that I'm stealing from Patrick McEwen, basically are you, you know, most offenses are number one, number five, or number six, meaning they want, you know, North Carolina is a number one offense. They want Chris Gray initiating the offense. He's their best offensive player, and he's typically going to be guarded by the opponent's best defensive player. And then pretty much every other offense is oriented around attacking short sticks. And the largest variety comes from, do we think that our second best offensive midfielder is so much better than our third best offensive midfielder that we want to attack the better of the two short sticks? Or are we trying to pick at the worst defensive player on the field who's typically going to be guarding our worst offensive player? And I mean, no slight to Hilburn, but he was the guy that just got elevated to the first line. So I think it's pretty easy to say he's the number six guy on the Terriers offense. He initiated the possession out of timeout, tied, season on the line. He looks like he was just kind of lightly carrying down the lefty alley with an intention of banging it through X, but Lehigh pressed out and he lost his safety valve option. So he carried 2X, kind of settled, didn't really know, for lack of a better word, what to do. So threw the ball more or less at the net and relied on one of his teammates finishing a spinning backhand flail bouncer in the direction of the net. It was pretty incredible. And by virtue of that, they're going to they're hosting the Patriot League Championship. It was an incredible end to a game.
It really was. And this, you know, admittedly, these are two teams I haven't watched a whole heck of a lot of this year.
By the way, it was Timmy Lee that scored, or Timmy Lay that scored that game winner. I should have said his name, but I wanted to look it up to make sure I got the right guy. And no offense to the three BU attackmen, but you guys are all the same stature, so you basically look the same.
Yeah, you don't like it? Well, then
one of you grow 4 inches, and the other one use a different colored stick.
Well, and Boston's really interesting because, you know, they only have three losses. Of course, their three losses are to the only three Ivy League teams that they've played all year. Damn it. But I just
love, they're the Rosetta Stone for how good the Ivy League actually is.
Yeah, which just sucks. I love, and I think that teams like Boston have really represented how far gone, like, even guys like myself are from the college game, because I remember the best play I saw in person from a pure stick skills, how dare you have the audacity to do that, was a Matt Kavanaugh around the world finish on a man up late in the second quarter against Denver at Denver to tie the game. And I was like, well, that's probably going to be the most ridiculous thing I had ever seen in my life. And now teams like Boston playing against Lehigh with a lot on the line are going spinning backhand. He even put like a little English on it, if my memory serves. Like, I don't know what switched or what these practices are looking like. If I even tried that, I probably would have torn my hamstring and separated my shoulder at the same time. And now we have players that are doing this in marquee moments of the game. And it like plays like that. I don't know much about Lehigh or Boston, but seeing plays like that on Twitter and like go viral and stuff like that, it honestly makes me like more excited for the game of lacrosse moving forward. I'm like, shit, if we got some people excited over lacrosse back in the way that we played it, the shit that people are doing now that's just kind of wacko is going to be much more exciting for the casual fan. And it's going to make people that like happen to turn it on or, you know, happen to see it scrolling in passing, like, what is going on with these college guys? So I just, plays like that make my cold, dead heart warm about the future of the sport, because the floor is getting so much higher. Even for a good Boston team, I don't think you would have seen something like this a couple years ago, and now it's seemingly happening once every other weekend.
One more set of games to get to. Richmond 16, High Point 5. The Spiders shut out the Panthers 9-0 in the second quarter. I'm sorry, second half. And it's going to be an interesting SoCon tournament. I don't know the extent to which maybe High Point shut it down a little bit, realizing that they're going to have a rematch with the Spiders regardless in High Point in a week. Well, when I say regardless, like, you know what I mean. More likely than not. Meanwhile, Jacksonville Dolphins have gotten through the remainder of their SoCon schedule. Their RPI has dipped to number 23. They are, despite all of the positivity around them over the course of this season, AQ or bust. So hopefully your boys can make it happen, right?
Yeah, I hope so. And the SoCon is another one that kind of, throws my brain for a loop, only because I seemingly kind of looped Richmond and High Point together recently, and Jacksonville to an extent, as far as like the one of these teams is going to start snagging. We kind of went in depth about it when Richmond beat Virginia, far as like this could change things. And I kind of threw in High Point and Jacksonville. They're going to start getting some sneaky recruits. I think I did a disservice to Richmond, who seems to be head and shoulders above High Point. So I would almost make the distinction that it's Richmond and Jacksonville, and then a little bit High Point has some work to do. But I even remember, do you remember when they played that game against Virginia when Tim Trautner stood on his head and came away with a win at Klockner a couple years back?
Yes, I do remember. They've beaten him twice in Virginia.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this is kind of a big turning point for High Point. So to see them lose by 11 to Richmond kind of blows my mind. And maybe I'll just ask you, how big of a gap is there between Richmond, Jacksonville, and High Point? Because I think, first off, Jacksonville beat Richmond. So we'll say, what is the separation of how quality those teams are?
Okay, so just a little bit of a history lesson. Jacksonville's first season was in 2010. The other two, High Point started in 2013. Richmond started in 2014. Jacksonville has had three coaches, Matt Kerwick, Guy Van Arsdale, and then now John Galloway. The other two are being coached by the guys who founded the programs. Richmond as an institution is, much more firmly established, has a much longer history than either of the other two, much more exclusive from an admission standpoint, really unique in terms of the way that it approaches financial aid as well. So the ability to recruit there in terms of the quality of the degree that it offers, as well as the way that it can be affordable, is different from the other two. In addition to which, any program that's winning an FCS football championship as an athletic department brings a lot to the table. High Point, a little bit more, and I say this as a term of endearment, new money. They've gotten an incredible influx by virtue of how dynamic their president is, and the building on campus has been absolutely jaw-dropping over the course of the last 15 years. When you go there, it's like going to a country club. And the program has, I think, really grown in parallel. So to me, I think that the best way to reflect the hierarchy of the programs is to say Richmond has won, I believe, 4 conference championships. High Point has won 2. Jacksonville has won 0. And I think that is, you know, essentially the pacing that I would use to separate them. High Point won last year. Jacksonville has been the best team so far this year. Richmond has been the most consistent comparatively over the course of the last 7 years. So all of that is to say, in terms of where they're at going forward, candidly, I think Jacksonville is probably the most tenuous. And I think part of that is a reflection of the year-to-year nature in which they built this roster. They have a number of 4- and 5-year players that are contributing, right? But they also have a handful of transfers that, whether it's Max Wahlbaum or Luke Milliken, I believe Colin Hinton is a transfer, but maybe I'm just misremembering because he was originally committed to Maryland. You know, some of their best players, you don't know how sustainable it is that they're going to get the next version of that guy, right? Caden Johnson goes to Ohio State instead of going to Jacksonville when he transfers out of North Carolina. What does that mean for that position going forward? So, you know, it's also not to say that, like, some of these other programs haven't benefited from transfers as well. I mean, Austin Geisler was High Point's first, like, starting awesome goalie, and he was a transfer from Virginia. So that's not the point that I'm making. The point that I'm making is that I just think that if you were to pick who's going to win the most conference championships over the next 5 years, Jacksonville would be the team that I would pick third among those three teams, whereas Richmond and High Point are a little bit closer to each other, is kind of the way they would shake out. All that being said, the SoCon's going away. They're not going to be competing against each other. High Point and Richmond are going to be playing in the A-10. Jacksonville's going to join the A-Sun. They're not going to be playing against each other anymore. The A-Sun, much different looking, right? Like, your former employers are part of that. Utah is emerging as the monster that is going to have to be dealt with. They, I believe, clinched the number one seed in the A-Sun tournament by virtue of a 12-11 win over Bellarmine on Saturday. And then Detroit Mercy, Cleveland State, Mercer, like, these are programs with very different identities from one another. It's kind of a catch-all league. I think it's really enticing and really interesting to see Jacksonville in that group and, you know, going toe-to-toe with Utah. I think that that'll be a nice rivalry over the course of the next few years.
Got it. Well, that's better. That's a better answer than I ever expected to hear. I got a history lesson. I learned a little bit. I heard about the trajectory. And
you're welcome, Nick. Yeah, we have a lot of making up to do because we didn't serve the people their free podcast last week.
Yeah. Hey, you don't like it? Then next time, Venmo me and Terry $20 each, and then we'll put out an episode. How about that? Put some responsibility back on your shoulders. When you point your fingers, where are the other three facing? Right at you, fellow listener. But please tune in next week as well.
Closing note, the University of Virginia went to the Carrier Dome, or formerly known as Carrier Dome, beat Syracuse 21-15. This used to be a game that would have led this show. That's all I have to say about that.
Syracuse Final Four prediction looking better and better every week.
Love you, Nick.
Love you too, Terry.
Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the Tailgate.